Want to immerse yourself in sport and the stories of athletes from across the Pacific? Well, join me, Sam Wykes, alongside some of the most talented journalists and sports commentators from across the region for Fresh Off the Field. Each week, we'll also bring you interviews with Pacific athletes leaving their mark on the international stage and those aspiring to do the same. From cricket to netball, athletics to football, and everything in between. Listen to Fresh Off the Field on your favorite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Manuia Letaiao, Morena and Goodfellow Morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Coming up, villagers are concerned of low-level volcanic eruption in Vanuatu.
And it's been really big effect for the villages around there, and most of them were thinking of maybe there will be more explosions, so they're thinking of moving out. There were like 2 centimetres of ice falling.
Samoa's government is set to implement new media rules, even background checks on journalists. We get the latest on politics and sports from the Kingdom of Tonga, and we shine a light on gender violence with 16 days of activism.
For example, if the wife asking, requesting help to them financially, they are demanding, if you're not sending me a nude picture of your own body, I won't be sending you this amount of money you're requesting.
Those stories and more here on Pacific Beat, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm your host, Aggie Dubon, and again, this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We start in Vanuatu, where people on the island of Ambe have been experiencing what authorities are calling a low-level volcanic eruption. For just over a week now, the volcano Manorivui has been belching out sulphur and ash, prompting Vanuatu's Geohazard Department to issue a 2-kilometre no-go zone around the crater. The last major eruption was in 2017 and 2018, which led to the evacuation of more than 10,000 people. Chief Jackson Ikipas recently visited Ambe, and he told the ABC's Lea Lonbu that the ashfall is damaging food gardens and water sources.
I was just passing through the day before in Ambe, and witnessing the high sort of sulfur and ash going up through the air. And we were passing through just outside with MV, the ship called MV Funotukaku, and we stopped several places. And I managed to go ashore to talk to the locals about how they feel about the big heavy ash falling in Ambe. And it's been really big effect for the villages around there. And most of them were regretting, like, so they sort of like thinking of maybe there will be more explosions, so they're thinking of moving out. There were like 2 centimeters of ash falling, likely breaking all the branches of bananas and I would say cassava. And so the fruit crops are struggling now. So from the east up to the center, they are sort of facing difficulties with sort of spinach or vegetation or vegetables. It's a high concern, so we need to monitor them very carefully. Otherwise, these people have to evacuate again if this activity keeps going for another few more days. Now it's forming quite a lot of ashes going up, and I just did a boss going up on FB, shouting out to the people, to the authorities, if they could check out the people around the area where they're affected.
So how long has this...
Well, it's like a whole night. The ashes has been falling. What I got from the locals around the area, that ashes has been going the whole night.
And just this week or during the weekend?
Yeah, it's been going through this weekend. So I haven't get back to them. So I'll be on the boat again tomorrow, and I'll be passing by, and I'll check them again, because when this ash goes up, there's some of the areas which are affected by the ash. They couldn't get the receptions. I couldn't manage to reach them, the locals in the communities, but I'll definitely pass it tomorrow and have a check again before traveling back to Botswana. So I'm with my concern. I'm really concerned about these people with the vegetation and vegetables and the health also. So Some of the schools were just closing up because the sulfur, the fog was really sort of covering them up.
So yeah, definitely there would be a serious concern in terms of, food and water and during going to school. Yeah. Have you heard on any response from the National Disaster Office?
Up there at the moment, I stopped with the headquarter aid. I had a little chat with the authorities over there, but they don't really have reaching out yet. They haven't reached, or they haven't got any support, any news from authorities yet. But I would say they're facing disaster. They're facing difficulties up on this island.
And you think there would be another evacuation if this get worse?
Well, apparently, yes. If it keeps going for another few more days, absolutely, they have to evacuate for this heavy low cloud and fogs going up, covering up and all the whole area.
And that's Chief Jackson Ikipas, and he was speaking there to ABC's Leah Lowenbu. Pacific Beat. Right, fresh from banning the country's only daily newspaper, Samoa's government is now developing rules for all media outlets that could include background checks on journalists. A draft media protocol obtained by the Samoa Observer requires questions for the Prime Minister's weekly press conference to be submitted 24 hours beforehand. In response to the Observer's report, the government says submitting questions ahead of press conferences would allow for more detailed and accurate responses. The government also says the journalists Association of Samoa was consulted on the protocol. So what do we make of it all? Joining us to share her thoughts is Samoan scholar and journalist Langi Boiva, Dr. Sherelle Jackson. With that, Malori Soifua Langi Boiva, thank you for joining us.
Malo Soifua, Malangi Ma Agnes, thank you for having me.
Always great to catch up. I mean, goodness, what was your first reaction when you saw the report about the media protocol?
I was very shocked and absolutely dismayed that, you know, that it has come to this for the Samoan government, for the new Samoan government.
Is there any sort of motivation you think is behind this? Well, why do you think they've gone this far?
I think what's happening right now is there is a deep desire by the new government to control the narrative. The new prime minister, you know, came into power with an immense following on social media, both in Samoa and in the diaspora. And so he's been able to largely control his narrative. Now becoming prime minister and seated in a publicly, elected official position, he's no longer able to fully control the narrative as it comes to mainstream media. So it seems that in an effort to try and clamp down on the narrative and control any negative reporting on his governance and his leadership, this is what he has resorted to, and that is banning the newspapers, Samoa Observer, and also trying to clamp down on how the media interacts with him by imposing such measures as checking the background of journalists and newsrooms, requesting questions beforehand, vetting who enters his office, and vetting who has one-on-one interviews with him.
Okay, Boiva, I know, are any of these sort of kinds of restrictions maybe new, or does the protocol that he's just trying to formalise and codify maybe what other governments have done in the past?
What the protocol actually, what actually it outlines, it doesn't actually differ from some of the requirements by other leaders around the world. So, you know, having done yourself and myself, having done these interviews with leaders internationally, there is usually a request for questions to come ahead of time, for them to check your background, check your media organizations and so forth. So this is actually not, these aspects of the protocol that is cited by Samoa Observer are not actually so far-fetched, right? It fits within what is usually required from leaders to make sure that, you know, their communications and what they're saying to the public is in line with their agendas and so forth. The issue is how this protocol came about. This protocol came about because of his discontent and inability to basically rein in some of the newsrooms in Samoa. So it is not surprising that it's come to this, but the way that it came about is is somewhat dictatorial in nature, and the approach is really not a way that a healthy democracy should conduct itself when it comes to the media. We also have to remember here that there is a press secretary in Samoa, and those rules are already in place. So it is a matter of how they've come about implementing this and the secrecy surrounding a protocol. The last protocol that existed in the Pacific was in Fiji. Mm. And that was, we all saw the results of that type of media protocol on the media in Fiji. It led to suppression and abuse of journalists and further restrictions on media freedom.
Well, that brings me to this question. I mean, it definitely sounds like quite a bit of an overreach. So is he in abuse of setting these types of laws on media, specifically there in Samoa?
It's certainly an abuse. I feel that this is an abuse of power. The way that this back and forth between the Prime Minister and Samoa Observer is, in my view, an abuse of power, because there are already mechanisms in place to standardize the way that the media reports, but also the way that the government interacts with the media. So it is the fact that he then intervenes and creates a specific restriction based on his observance or his experience of the media is certainly an abuse of power. However, it's also important to note that there have been some issues in regards to the way the media has reported in the past. And so that has resulted in some of this ill feeling. But I think at the end of the day, if you are a leader and the media is not doing their job to what you, to the narrative that you prefer, or the accountability or the level of excellence or reporting that you as a leader would like to see in your country, there are measures in place for that to be observed and for that to be, for him to go through. There's defamation. There's the crimes ordinance. Unfortunately, that defamation is in there. There is a media council. The media council, the media council exists, and the government should support the media council so that it upholds the standards of journalism in Samoa. So that's really one other aspect. One direct thing that the Prime Minister and the government can do is actually support the media council by funding it so that it upholds the standards of journalism. But to really answer your question, this is an abuse of power. Mm. He holds ultimate power in Samoa, and he is asserting that power, outside of the confines of the mechanisms that should uphold the standards of journalism in Samoa.
Mm. Langipoiva, from afar, it really does seem like the Prime Minister's top priority since returning from medical leave in New Zealand is all about tightening media control. I mean, is that a fair description? And really, are there not other issues that he really should be looking at?
Certainly. I mean, this should be the very least of his concerns. There are much more pressing concerns for Samoa from a media perspective. So as a journalist, I would love to see, where he stands on climate change. What is the result of the recent, climate conference, and where does Samoa stand, under his leadership in terms of climate change? There's been a lot of discussions. And as you know, there's 16 days, on observance of actions on violence against women. There are so many more priorities that he as a leader could utilize the media as a way to really spread information and create awareness about what his priorities are. Personally, for me, whenever I see a letter to the editor from a prime minister or any leader in the world, that is a misuse of time, because there are mechanisms in place for journalists and for the media to adhere to certain standards. So to answer that, there are certainly other issues and more, better priorities for a leader to focus on rather than a tit for tat with a national newspaper.
So, well, do you think then we can probably expect more restrictions on the media in the future if this is pretty much where he's heading at the moment?
I mean, everything points towards that. We started with accusations against the media and journalists. And then it led to the banning of the Samoa Observer. And now we're looking into a protocol to basically control and restrict media access to him. I think this points towards even more oppressive conditions when it comes to media and access to information. For me, this is a slippery slope for a democracy. It is a slippery slope in that as when you try to control the narrative and control the media, that basically means that you are not allowing people or the public to really have free access to the information regarding the decision makers and those of whom they voted into parliament. So this is the first, in my entire career as a journalist in Samoa, this is the first time a media protocol as such has been established, mainly because the press secretary already exists to control access to the prime minister, and therefore them creating another layer or another control mechanism is really not a good sign for Samoa's democracy.
Langiboiva, it has been great to chat to you. I think there's still a lot to unravel and unpack on this situation, but I know we'll be keeping across this. So again, Faftai Terelava for your time today.
Faftai.
And that is Samoan scholar and journalist Langiboiva, Dr. Sherelle Jackson.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We're heading into gold, copper, LNG. It's what Papua New Guinea has built its economy on with natural resources. But now the next big boom isn't underground. It's on top, on the rugby league field. That's the pitch to foreign investors, with the idea of mateship and besties underpinning PNG's new rugby league approach. Evan Wasuka with more.
It's known as the Papua New Guinea Mining and Investment Expo. But this year, at the Sydney conference, mining took a backseat and rugby league took center stage.
For every one of us in this room, I know that the entry of the PNG Chiefs into the NRL is a deeply exciting prospect.
With Australia investing $600 million into PNG's new NRL team, it was no surprise that Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese was on stage to spruik the PNG Chiefs.
It's a celebration of shared culture between PNG and Australia, certainly, but it also represents, importantly, new opportunities for investment. Football games held in Port Moresby increased tourism and economic opportunity.
Another big name to take the stage at this mining event was the NRL boss Peter Velandes. He was quick to give credit where it was due.
In every generation you have a visionary, and Papua New Guinea's got one in Prime Minister Marape. I think he's got a vision for that country that is unmatched, and we want to be part of that vision, and that's why we've thrown everything into it. And one thing that sport is underrated, and how powerful sport is, sport glues communities together, and in this case it's glued our countries together. We've gone from being mates to being besties. That's what that I'm about.
PNG's Prime Minister James Marape was regaled as the man of the hour, but he was quick to put the focus back on the economic benefits of having a team in the NRL.
And the National Rugby League team we have coming on in 2028, and I take my hats off to NRL for believing in the vision. That is part of the major focus we want our nation united as ever. And that unity will find its value in people participating in the economy.
One new initiative that's largely gone under the radar is a push for a new Australian visa category, tied in to PNG's new team for players and fans alike. It was something that Prime Minister James Marape flagged prior to his arrival in Australia for the conference.
By the way, Australian government, I think they'll be announcing tomorrow also, there's a special category of visa being opened up just for this NRL season. So it's a 1-year visa, and so it's opening up, so keep a lookout for this.
Although the official announcement and details have yet to come, Australia's Pacific Minister, Pat Conroy, says the new visa is on its way.
We will be announcing shortly the visa options that allow that to happen. So not only will we see the Chiefs travelling to Townsville to play the Cowboys, you'll see Papua New Guineans travelling to support their team, and you'll see tourist dollars going into local economies and supporting Aussie jobs.
Papua New Guinea's new NRL team may still be 2 years away from taking the field, but already it's making its impact felt in business, investment and politics.
Well, there you go. Not just mates, but besties. That was Evan Wasuka reporting on PNG's new rugby league team. But we'll have to wait until 2028 to see if they live up to those expectations. We go to Tonga now, where there's anticipation and excitement ahead of Monday's Prime Minister's election. But the lead-up to the election itself is proving to be just as exciting, with the suspension of a high-profile minister. And that's not all. Outside of Parliament, there's also drama surrounding Tonga's rugby league team and potential sanctions from the NRL. For more on Tonga politics and sport, we head to Nuku'alofa to join the ABC's Tongan reporter, Marian Kupo. Malata mai bongbongini, Marian. A lot is happening there in the kingdom, but let's start off with Piveni Piukala. I know he's the police minister, but why has the prime minister suspended him from his duties?
Yes, Aggie, the prime minister suspended Piveni Piukala because of allegations that he interfered with a court order. Now, that order restricted a Tongan residing overseas named Pita Hopoate from leaving the country after he was charged in a criminal defamation case, a case that hasn't yet gone to trial. Now, according to the Anti-Corruption Commission, the minister intervened at the airport and allowed Hopoate to travel despite the travel ban. And that became a major issue when Hopoate failed to show up to his scheduled court hearing a few weeks ago.
Wow.
Now, Aggie, so the Prime Minister says in a press release sent out yesterday that the suspension is necessary while they investigate whether the minister improperly undermined a court process. The government is also framing it as a move to protect public confidence and also to ensure the investigation could proceed fairly. Now, that is why he was suspended.
Yeah, that's a big allegation there. So I'm wondering, has Piveni himself said anything in response to his suspension?
Oh, yes, definitely he has. Piukala is strongly pushing back. He says the entire suspension is unlawful because, according to him, under the Tonga's constitution, only the king, on advice of the PM, can revoke a minister. So there is no provision, as he states in his letter that ABC got hold of yesterday, that the prime minister cannot, or Prime Minister, don't have any provision to individually suspend a minister. He also defends his action at the airport, arguing the restraining order itself was improperly issued. So that there was no bail hearing. He says no chance for the defendant to be heard. And then he also states that the order violated basic legal rights under the Bail Act. He says enforcing such a law is a flawed under would have been an act of injustice. So he's urging the PM to reconsider the suspension and he's calling out the Prime Minister, saying it's unconstitutional and ultra-virus beyond the PM legal powers.
Wow. Look, for many who may not even know who Piveni Piukala is, look, we know that he rose to prominence a few months ago for actually punching another MP in Parliament. I mean, Marian, tell us a little bit about Piukala. Like, what do we know about him?
Yes, Aggie. Piukala was certainly a high-profile figure during this term when he hit headline earlier this year after punching a fellow noble representative inside Parliament during an heated exchange. So I have to understand, despite that controversy, he still remains a politically influential figure, especially in his constituency. He holds three major portfolios: police, fire and emergency services, and also the Minister of Public Enterprises. And as you can hear from his response letter, that I've quoted, he's also not shy about defending his interpretation of the law and his ministerial powers. So he is some kind of interesting character, I should say.
Nice. Good to know. Marion, I do want to sort of switch gears here, because obviously there's another incident that's really attracted international attention. That's the NRL decision to ban Tonga's team head doctor, the trainers, over that serious head injury, you know, to player Elias Akaatoa during Tonga's match against New Zealand. I'm wondering, what's the fallout from this decision by the NRL?
Yeah, the fallout has been huge. Like this story has really shaken Tonga's rugby league community. The NRL has issued those breach notices to Tonga's team doctor and two trainers, like you mentioned, saying they mishandled a serious head injury to star forward Elias Akaatoa during the test against New Zealand. Well, for many Tongans, the immediate reaction has been a lot of concern for Akaatoa's well-being, followed by the frustration at how such an incident could happen at a test level, but also waiting for the full process to run its course before drawing any conclusions. Yeah.
Has there been any word from the Tonga National Rugby League Federation? What have they said about the NRL notice?
Yes, so ABC did reach out to him, the Federation, through its chairman, Lord Fafanua, the outgoing Speaker of the House, has acknowledged receiving the breach notices. He also says that the Tonga rugby team management and medical staff have fully cooperated with the NRL throughout the investigation. And now that formal notices have been issued, the staff will respond within the required time frame. But most importantly, Tonga Rugby says it won't comment further until the process is finished, and out of due respect for the due process, and also just to avoid predicting the outcome.
Okay, well, let's head back to politics again. Before we let you go, Marion, we understand the PM's election. Do we have any confirmed nominations, though, for the candidates?
Yes and no. So far, only one nomination as of date. I remember I did report on the interim Speaker of Parliament, Lord Tangi, did announce all nominations are due this Friday, where he would then announce the nominations. There is still unconfirmed names, but three names are widely expected to be out there when Tonga's 26 elected MPs vote on Monday. So we have the names such as Dr. Isaac Eke, the caretaker prime minister. We also have Lofa Fanua, the outgoing Speaker of Parliament, and also former Prime Minister Sal Sovaleni. There's also speculation about former Prime Minister Sal Sovaleni, through his previous tension with the palace, may make other MP hesitant to back him up. So it's shaping up to be a very competitive race. And the next few days, say to one day of negotiation, the usual horse trading will be very crucial.
Well, yes, we will wait until Monday to find out those results. But Marion, always great to catch up. Thank you very much for keeping us informed of what's happening there in Tonga.
Maloa pito egi ofatu.
Ofatu. That is ABC's reporter in Tonga, Marion Kupu, here on Pacific Beat.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys. Join us for Stories from the Pacific, Wednesdays at 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia, or where you get your podcasts.
Good morning and welcome back to Pacific Beat. Bougainville is moving closer to its goal of independence from Papua New Guinea, with both governments agreeing to a major milestone that's been set for June next year. Where PNG has committed to tabling the result of a 2019 non-binding independence referendum, which saw more than 97% of Bougainvillians voting for independence from PNG. Bougainville's Vice President and Attorney General Ezekiel Massat has welcomed the move, but he warns should PNG's Parliament decide not to ratify the result, then his people would go after alternative but legal ways to become independent.
Well, what needs to happen by June 2026 is one, that we had signed off on the Melanesian Agreement. Negotiations would have been complete. Sessional orders had been agreed to by the two speakers of the House. We would have by then a report by the bipartisan committee to the National Parliament. And therefore, by June 2026, we expect the National Parliament to be, if not complete, the ratification process.
How confident are you that the Papua New Guinea Parliament is actually going to ratify the results of the referendum?
Some years ago and some months ago, I had tried to explain to people that getting independence through the peace process, which involved referendum and ratification, is the step for independence. There are other options that are open to Bougainville to gain independence, not just by ratification. And I have stressed to the national government that despite these other options being open, that we have engaged in this process because we want to gain independence through consensus. But if they are not interested, then it is my right as minister, it is my right as the Bougainville leader to implement the wishes of my people, constitutionally guaranteed referendum where 97.7% had voted for independence. So let me make it absolutely clear that if the national government pussyfoots around on this issue, we're not going to sit around and accept any nonsense. I trust the national government enough. I trust this prime minister enough to be able to say, yes, I'll leave these other options of gaining independence aside and proceed by way of a consensus. And if the two governments had agreed to a certain activity and a certain time to be met, and two sides to commit themselves to whatever they've agreed. So that's the long and the short of the answer.
Now, Mr. Massat, what else would you like to say here if the independence referendum result is not passed by Parliament?
The Bougainville leadership and the national government leadership and the whole world knows about these other options that are open. And therefore, it will come as no surprise that if the national government does not commit to an agreed process, that it leaves us with no options but to those other options to gain independence. And let me make it absolutely clear that these options are also legal. It's not an illegal option. I'm not looking at a unilateral declaration of independence. I'm looking at a legalized declaration of independence, constitutionally guaranteed referendum that was observed and endorsed by the international community. So those options are open, and we do not wish to be pushed into a position that we then take some of this, which might be unpleasant to the national government and the international community. Having said that, Sam, listen, I trust this government enough that when they put pen to paper that they are serious in the commitment. So let's, assuming certain things will not happen. If it does not happen, then you can call me back and I'll tell you what my next options will be.
And that there is Bougainville's Attorney General, Ezekiel Massat. And you're speaking there to Sam Siki from the ABC's One Talk program. Just a quick recap of our stories so far. People on the island of Ambai have been experiencing a low-level volcanic eruption with ashfall damaging food gardens and water sources. Also, Samoa's government set to implement new media rules, even background checks on journalists. And we got the latest on politics and sports from the Kingdom of Tonga. But still to come, up next it will be your news headlines, and we shine a light on gender violence with 16 days of activism. All that here on Pacific Beat.
Hold
Yes, Faftai Tinilava for joining us here on Pacific Beat. It is their time. We get the latest headlines from around the region, brought to you by our producer, Whinau Whonua. Joining me in the studio this morning, Whewehake.
I'm fine, thank you.
Good to have you here this morning. We head to Fiji. Their health ministry, they've issued a measles warning amid rising cases in Australia and New Zealand, though. Can you tell us a little bit more?
Yeah, Fiji's Ministry of Health and Medical Services is warning the Fijian public of a potential measles risk from travellers returning from New Zealand and Australia. New Zealand has reported around 30 measles cases. Australia's recorded 162 this year. Health authorities in both countries are continuing to monitor the situation.
Yeah.
But Fijian health authorities are urging the public to ensure their children are fully vaccinated. As you know, health authorities in Pacific nations are very cautious of measles. The measles vaccination rate in Fiji is just above 95%, but that remaining 5% numbers in the thousands of people. So hence the persistent calls for people to make sure their children are vaccinated.
Wow. Okay then. Oh, well, we'll keep our eyes and ears on that one. I hear 36 Solomon Islands students have received scholarships from the Australian government. That's a substantial number. Can you give us more details?
Yeah. Solomon Star reports 16 women and 20 men have received scholarships to study at top universities across Australia. This year's cohort includes two PhDs, 28 masters and 6 undergraduates. And this scholarship program is part of an ongoing development partnership with Australia, efforts to boost the human capital in the Solomon Islands. More than 700 Solomon Islanders, in fact, have benefited from Australia scholarships since 2006.
Wow, beautiful. Okay, well, all the best for those who have received those scholarships. We hear this, this is sort of a common story we often hear within sport, but New Zealand Samoan boxing champion Joseph Parker has spoken out for the first time about a failed drug test. What did he actually have to say, Fido?
He denied that he did anything wrong. The drug test followed his fight against British fighter Fabio Wardley, who he lost to in a controversial stoppage in the 11th round. Most commentators says it was a premature stoppage. Parker was ahead in that fight on points. But regardless, he failed the drug test following that fight, testing positive for cocaine. Parker had been waging a legal case to get his name cleared and was interviewed by Boxing King Media about this. He said he couldn't say too much for legal reasons, but here's a snippet of what he said in that interview.
Okay. I did nothing wrong. Fighting the case, innocent, did nothing wrong, and I'm ready to go again. Once I get my name cleared, lock me in for another fight as soon as possible. I did nothing wrong in camp, I did nothing wrong before the fight, and it'll come out soon.
Parker. It's quite a serious case because if he fails to clear his name, he could face a mandatory suspension from the ring for up to 2 years, which would be devastating. Up until his loss to Wardley last month, he was already being lined up to fight Alexander Usyk, who's the current heavyweight boxing champion. So unfortunate that can't happen anytime soon.
Okay, yeah, that will be something that we will be watching to see. I mean, yeah, that's a big suspension if it does, fail. All right, well, as always, Whinau, thank you for bringing us the latest in our headlines from around the region here on Pacific Beat.
Join me, Melissa Makin, for Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference. Nisha Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday from 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
No, Māori, welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie DeBoer. Well, today, December 10th, it marks the end of 16 days of activism. It's a period every year where the spotlight is shone brightly on gender violence. According to UNICEF's latest reports, Fiji and the Solomon Islands rank among the world's worst offenders on gender violence. Yet, just across their borders, neighbouring Vanuatu is showing signs of real progress in tackling this issue. Community advocate Edmund Saksak says he is seeing positive results from empowering women in the Port Vila community of Black Sands.
Big day for my community. I think it's the first time that we have a big event
We have the representatives of UNFPA, the Vanuatu Women's Center, and some representatives of the national government and the other NGOs that are with us to support our women in the community. And, you know, I've never seen a big number of women that have attended such events like that. I think that impact from, you know, after the earthquake of December last year, after that we have those safe spaces for girls and women, and then it leads up to, you know, keeping the women together. It's part of the 16th day of activism for gender-based violence, you know.
True. You mentioned a little bit about, you know, the workshop and how the community were able to discuss around how the community can work more better in addressing the issue of domestic violence and violence against women and girls in the community. And there was a bit of suggestion around having workshop for men to help them understand more about this issue. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
We were given an assignment to try to find a solution, or not really a solution, but a thing to bring men to the table, like, you know, bring them down to our level so they know that even though they have power in the community or in families, or the influence in the community or families, but to bring them down so they know that listening to women or girls or listening to youth, their children, is important.
And was that a suggestion from the Black Sand community for the NGOs to engage in those type of workshop?
Yes, it was a suggestion from the community. If they go through this the leadership training, it will be a big benefit for the whole community.
Mm-hmm. So yes, definitely a good thing about this kind of workshop is that everybody gets to share their thoughts. People could get to hear, you know, the ideas of men in the workshop. So it's really good suggestion from the community. Can you talk a little bit about the statistics of domestic violence and violence against women and girls that the Women's Center talked about?
They have 1,000 cases that have been reported to them recently, and they said this 1,000 doesn't mean that that's it. That's the exact number. We still have like more unreported cases of violence.
And there was also a bit of mention around online abuse, sexual abuse. That's also been one of the awareness by the Women's Center.
Yes. They've mentioned that recently there have been cases where like reports to them, the thing to do with the REC, like especially male, demanding nude pictures from their wives or girlfriends in Vanuatu, when their wives, for example, if their wives are requesting help to them financially, for financial help, they are demanding, if you're not sending me a nude picture of your own body, I won't be, you know, sending you this amount of money you're requesting. So,
yeah, so just overall, your thoughts in terms of violence against women and girls, you're an advocator yourself. How have you seen the impact of the work that's done over the years in the communities in Port Vila? Has it had a huge impact?
Positively, yes. How? I've never seen that before, but this year I was so overjoyed by witnessing women coming together to organize something, an activity, recently in in our community, we have this flea market organized by the Black Sands Association of Women. That is one new association that brings all women together. I think it's a positive thing to see that women are striving to be a positive light to the community, to see that there is hope for a better tomorrow for our community. And they're trying to shine out to everyone. We have all these challenges in our community, but coming together like this is a show of strength. But if the community comes together and rally behind all these women, I think we will have a better, strong and healthy community. And we can just by doing this, we are safeguarding our community for the upcoming generations.
And that there is Edmund Saksak, a community advocate, speaking with reporter Leah Lowenboo. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at our main story today, with villagers in Vanuatu concerned about low-level volcanic eruption activity with low ash emissions causing some damage to plantations.
And it's been really big effect for the villages around there. And most of them were thinking of maybe there will be more explosions, so they're thinking of moving out. There were like 2 centimetres of ash falling.
Find those stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. But our team will be back tomorrow, same time at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. As always, stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it's Nija Daily. So until next time, odua ofa atu. I'm your host, Aggie Dubol. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.